More and more people across the country are getting vaccinated every day as states continue to expand eligibility requirements. But vaccine distribution for incarcerated Americans still lags behind the general population. And that's despite the fact that prisons and jails have been hotbeds of outbreaks during the pandemic. So far, there have been more than 390,000 COVID-19 cases among incarcerated people in the United States, largely because of insufficient medical care and people being unable to socially distance while living in such tight quarters. That's according to data from the Marshall Project. Two recent rulings aim to change this. On Monday, a New York State Supreme Court justice issued a ruling requiring New York to immediately begin offering vaccines to all incarcerated people. That ruling echoes a similar one made last month in Oregon. I'm Tanzina Vega, and a look at the uneven vaccine rollout for incarcerated people nationwide is where we begin today on The Takeaway. Nicole Lewis is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, focusing on felony disenfranchisement. Nicole, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
And Lauren Brinkley Rubenstein is an assistant professor of social medicine at University of UNC Chapel Hill and head of the COVID-19 Prison Project. Lauren, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We'll start with you, Lauren. Before we even talk about vaccines, what are we looking at when it comes to case numbers and deaths in prisons and jails nationwide most recently?
So we continue to see a rise in cases disproportionate to the general population. There have been about 400,000 cases nationwide. About 20% of the population of incarcerated people have had COVID, over 2,500 deaths. One of the real problems, though, is as we start to focus on vaccination, we're seeing less and less data. And so it's hard to tell in recent weeks what cases look like because states have becoming more opaque relevant to what's happening behind the walls.
Nicole, we're talking about vaccine rollout here, but it seems like this population has not been a priority or it's been varied from state to state.
Yeah, that's right. And so there are several states that put incarcerated people in phase one, you know, kicked off in January, Massachusetts, New Jersey, for example. But then there are several states for which we still actually don't know where incarcerated people are going to fall. And so folks in Florida have no information about when they'll be vaccinated. Large systems like Texas only just started vaccinating people a few weeks ago. And so this is just very mixed across the country and still very unclear.
And Nicole, we mentioned at the top that New York State issued a ruling where vaccines should be offered to its entire incarcerated population. That includes jails and prisons. How long is that going to take?
So it can really depend, right? New York is looking at about 50,000 people incarcerated here. And so it's not a huge number, but not a small number either. And so it's really important to remember that vaccine allocation, right, where these vaccines go is determined by the state. And so if they weren't figured into the plan, you know, weeks ago, months ago, that those vaccines may not be available, may not be ready to be directly shipped into the prisons, right? And so prisons are also spread out across the state. So it could take some time before we are able to see a robust vaccination campaign behind bars, but it is decidedly good news.
Lauren, I was listening to a report today on a sister program here on public radio, and they were talking about homeless populations being vaccinated, and they're seeing much success with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because it's a one shot only. It doesn't require two shots, and it also can be stored. It requires less rigorous storage requirements. In other words, you can put it in a refrigerator, not something like Moderna or Pfizer that require very specific storage temperatures. When we talk about what type of vaccine could be used for incarcerated populations, is that what they're considering, or do we not know yet?
So it's pretty variable across the country. Many of the states that started early vaccination did use Pfizer or Moderna and figured out how to do that, mostly in partnership with departments of public health locally or at the state level. We have seen some states start to use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. I think all three are on the table. As you mentioned, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is really great because it just requires one shot, not two. That's really important in the context of high turnover carceral spaces such as jails. And so I think we're seeing it all on the table, but Johnson & Johnson does help us overcome some of the barriers that are inherent to jails and prisons.
Lauren, what about when it comes to testing? Is there any type of rigorous testing happening in incarceration for incarcerated people, and particularly in places like jails, where, as you said, the turnover rate is quite high?
Yeah, so as with everything, we're seeing a lot of variability across the country. We have some jails in this country that are highly resourced and some that are very, lack resources and have virtually no testing on board. We have seen more testing happen recently than happened, say a year ago at the beginning of the pandemic. We've also seen uptake of surveillance methods using rapid antigen tests. And so we've seen more testing than in the past, still not enough adequate testing, but we've seen some targeted populations such as transfers from facility to facility or new intakes or on release. And so we're seeing some testing plans see light, but definitely not as much as we would have wanted.
Nicole, you've done a lot of reporting around this issue. One of the things you've reported on was you surveyed incarcerated people earlier this month to get a sense of how they were feeling about getting the vaccine. What stood out to you in their responses?
That's right. I'd say the biggest thing we found was that this year behind bars during a pandemic, where most prisons have been in lockdown, people haven't been able to see their families, has been so hard on incarcerated people that it is, creating some interest and encouraging people to get vaccinated. So many people were saying that they see this shot as a potential way of getting off of lockdown and having some return to normalcy. And so that's, a really important and interesting finding.
Now, on the flip side of that, Nicole, you also did reporting on vaccine hesitancy, except this time we're talking about corrections officers, the people who are working in the facilities. Tell us about what you found there.
That's right. And so on this side, we found sort of widespread hesitancy, refusal in some cases to get vaccinated. And so the reasons for that were really quite varied. On one side, we definitely had groups of people who believed in conspiracy theories about the vaccine, about what it might do to them. There's limited information. I think it was really important for some of the sources that we spoke to point out that, our correctional officers are not alone in this, right? Police officers, some nurses, right, have refused the vaccine at higher rates, sort of confusing public health officials. These folks are on the front lines. But in many cases, corrections officers have little education, tend to lean right, and we've seen national polls have shown us that Republicans, people with lower education, tended to be more hesitant, right? And so there's just a number of reasons for why this is happening. And I'd say my biggest concern there, that the thing that really stands out to me, is that in some cases it was interfering with incarcerated people's decision making around whether or not they should get vaccinated. This is a community of people who don't have really much or any connection to the outside world. They can't do research on their own. And so what corrections officers are telling them becomes incredibly important.
And it also, Lauren, I'm wondering your thoughts, doesn't that also present a, interesting scenario where the corrections officers who leave the facility and come home and go home and come back, if they choose not to be vaccinated, couldn't they also pose a risk to the incarcerated population?
That's right. And so, we've seen that staff in particular have exposure in their communities or exposure in the jail or prison setting, and then they bring that back home or they bring that back to work. And so they're putting, when folks decide to not get vaccinated and they are exposed to these high-risk settings, they are putting communities at risk. They're putting incarcerated folks at risk. And as Nicole said, it really, when you're an incarcerated person who has no agency many times over your decision-making, it might make you less likely to take the vaccine when you're offered it. And it also puts you at risk. I'm thinking a lot about variants too, as these new variants come on board that are much more contagious in the setting of prisons and jails. They've been hotbeds, as you noted, really the epicenter of the pandemic. But in the context of these variants, it becomes even more dangerous. And so it really underscores the importance of staff uptake of vaccines when they're made available.
Nicole, has this issue, I mean, it seems like so many things around the pandemic have been politicized. Has the vaccination of incarcerated communities become a political issue as well in your reporting?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So in several states, we saw that incarcerated people were prioritized. And then in some cases, the state legislature, oftentimes led by a group of Republicans, really pushed back, passed legislation, introduced, you know, resolutions to deprioritize these folks. There's been a ton of backlash on social media and online. I can't tell you about the number of, you know, local radio shows that I hear where people are framing this issue as, you know, murderers and rapists are going to get vaccinated before your grandmother, right? And it's just such a huge distortion to think about where, as Lauren said, the importance of the importance of vaccinating people who are incarcerated as a way to, you know, protect the whole community. And so it's just sort of politically fraught across the country.
Lauren, as we bring the segment to an end here, I'm wondering if there's something specific that you would like to see, whether it's states, which right now have a patchwork of different policies for vaccinating incarcerated populations, or from the federal government, that you think would help incarcerated people get access to vaccines in the coming weeks.
Sure. I mean, you know, the a giant piece of legislation, the American Recovery Act, was passed a couple of weeks ago. It mentions specifically congregate living facilities. It mentions jails and prisons once. I really think there's a space for the federal government to make a call that some of this money that's going to go to states to help pay for prevention activities such as testing or vaccines really be carved out for prisons and jails to develop interventions that increase awareness or information, education relevant to vaccines. You know, how COVID works, how the vaccines work. I also think there's something there around the mandating of data transparency. You know, the only reason why we know so much about COVID is because all the prison systems in this country launched public dashboards. And we were able to, in some ways, keep them accountable because we had information that we wouldn't have otherwise had. I think that same needs to go for vaccines and vaccine deployment. And some of that money can be tied to, that's given to the states from the federal government, can be tied to data transparency. I think that's pretty important and something that's kind of missing at the federal level currently.
Lauren Brinkley Rubenstein is an assistant professor of social medicine at UNC Chapel Hill and head of the COVID-19 Prison Project. And Nicole Lewis is a staff writer for the Marshall Project. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'd say it was around January I received my first letter from the New York State Department of Labor notifying me that I was eligible to receive pandemic unemployment assistance. And I thought it was strange because I didn't apply for unemployment insurance because I still have a job.
That's Jackie Martin, our line producer here at The Takeaway. And she's been working for the show since before the pandemic began. So when she got her first letter about her unemployment benefits, she just brushed it off. But then more letters kept coming in, and that's when she got suspicious.
I called my accountant, and she was like, let me look around, let me nose around. And she found an article from up here in Westchester with the DA warning Westchester residents of unemployment fraud.
That's right. Jackie was receiving those letters because someone was attempting to apply for unemployment benefits using her identity. And Jackie's not alone. Since the pandemic began, there have been more than 425,000 fraudulent unemployment benefit claims in New York State alone. Greg Iacursi is a personal finance reporter at CNBC, and he's here to help us understand the scope of the problem. Greg, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Greg, the scope of the problem nationwide, I mean, 425,000 cases in New York State alone, at least I should say, incidences of fraud. What are we, I mean, if that's happening in New York, what's the rest of the country look like?
That's right. Experts I've spoken to said that the unemployment fraud that's gone on nationwide is unlike anything that the system has seen before. And the system was created almost a century ago, back in the 1930s. Experts say that it likely affects at least 1 million people nationwide, and that's probably a conservative estimate. The Labor Department's Inspector General estimates that at least $63 billion will be lost to improper payments through the unemployment system, most of that due to fraud.
So let's talk a little bit about how this is happening, because we know that unemployment requests have increased. Lots more people have been out of work since the pandemic began. So is what we're seeing a result of that, or is it a result of the flaw of some sort of flaw in the system? I mean, what's opening the door to this level of fraud right now?
It's a couple of different things that are contributing to the problem. On the one hand, right, you have this flood of unemployed people coming into the system. So that sort of is like a masking agent, if you will. You know, 19 million people are still collecting unemployment benefits of some kind. And in the early days of the pandemic, like 6 million people rushed to claim benefits in 2 consecutive weeks. Prior to that, the prior record was less than 700,000 in any given week. So the scale of the problem is pretty massive. You also have states have fairly antiquated systems, not all of them, but a lot of them don't have very modernized systems, which experts say it makes it hard to be nimble in these sorts of situations. But perhaps the bigger problem, if you will, is back in March 2020, in the early days of the pandemic, the CARES Act established a program called Pandemic Unemployment Assistance. And that was for self-employed people, gig workers, freelancers, other types of workers who generally are not eligible to collect state unemployment insurance. There were some fairly lax requirements. You could self-attest, for example, that you were eligible for benefits. And that was sort of done in the name of getting benefits out to people quickly, but it also opened the door to fraud.
So how do we know? We just heard from our line producer who said she found out because she started getting these weird, you know, letters in the mail. And she said, well, I'd never applied for that. But how do most people find out that they've been a victim of fraud? Or do most people not find out that they've been a victim of fraud?
Yeah, unfortunately, they may not find out. Most people are finding out during tax season because they're receiving 1099-G tax forms in the mail or electronically. And those are basically tax forms that tell you how much unemployment income you received over the course of 2020. So people are getting these tax forms and they're saying, well, I didn't get unemployment benefits in 2020. Well, someone collected those benefits in your name, most likely.
Wow, this is going to be, tax season is upon us. And so this is going to, sounds like it's going to be pretty messy. What does this hurt people who are legitimately seeking unemployment assistance?
Yes, it could. Unless, you know, the individual gets it rectified with the state labor agency, it may be difficult for them to collect unemployment benefits if they need them in the future, because you can only collect as an unemployed person. There's a finite amount of benefits you can collect in any given year. So if you don't report it to the labor agency, then that could become a bit of a problem if you lose your job.
You also, mean if somebody has collected them in your name and you actually didn't know that, and then you need the unemployment, you could get denied.
Yeah, or eligible for fewer benefits than you would have otherwise been. And also, I mean, it means someone has stolen your personal data. So there's the chance they could open up lines of credit in your name, for example. So that, yeah, there are lots of reasons to be wary about this situation.
Greg, let's take a listen to what happened to Jackie, because after you are a victim of identity theft, it is difficult. So let's take a listen to how she had to deal with that.
I had to go to the state police, make a report. I had to go to the Department of Labor and report the fraud. I had to go to all 3 credit bureaus and report it with them, let them know that my social's out there. And there's a whole host of other things I have to do.
Greg, for people who are victims here, what do they need to do? Is what Jackie described pretty typical?
Unfortunately, yes. It is a bit of a process to get this all rectified, but it is important, as we discussed earlier, to do so. For one, otherwise you may owe tax on your benefits that you didn't get, or you might not be able to get them in the future. Also, someone has your personal information out there. So, you know, the first step is to report the fraud to the state labor agency. that issued the fraudulent benefits for people who received 1099 G tax forms. It would be the labor agency that issued that tax form to you. You could find the respective contact information for the state bureaus at dol.gov/fraud. There's a directory there for all those state labor agencies. The state is going to have to issue a corrected 1099 G to you just so the IRS has updated information and make sure that you won't owe tax on benefits you didn't receive. And then people need to check their credit reports. Like with Jackie, you have to go to like the major credit bureaus, Experian, TransUnion, Equifax, and think about putting some sort of a freeze on your credit or placing a credit fraud alert on your file, just so you know if someone tries to open up lines of credit in your name. And you have to report unemployment identity theft to the U.S. Department of Justice's National Center for Disaster Fraud. And by the way, all of these recommendations are coming straight from the Labor Department.
So, Greg, just one last question before we let you go here. I mean, unemployment benefits have also been politicized. Do you suspect that this type of these instances of fraud will further that?
It's a good question. There were steps taken by Congress to clamp down on fraud in the unemployment system. In December, when the $900 billion COVID relief package was passed, that contained some measures to reduce the amount that could potentially be stolen through fraudulent means, through the pandemic unemployment assistance program we spoke about earlier. Also put some documentation requirements in place for self-employed people to be able to prove they are who they say they are and that they lost employment income. So it seems like that was a fairly bipartisan achievement in that bill. I don't think either party, you know, wants to see money being stolen out of the unemployment system, especially when tens of billions of dollars of extra money is being funneled to unemployed workers during the pandemic.
Greg Iacursi is a personal finance reporter at CNBC. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
The fight over whether or not to unionize an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, is heating up as the vote count of its nearly 6,000 workers got underway on Tuesday.
All those good packages, I'm going to tell y'all a little bit what we went through to get y'all all those packages. For one, when this union come in, that frown is going to be a smile. Everybody is going to smile now. We're going to stop crying. We're going to stop worrying. We're going to stop doing all of that. Because we are Amazon. Bezos, he's just a CEO. But in all, we are Amazon.
That was Linda Burns, an Amazon facility worker. Though it's unclear when we'll see the results of the vote, the historic union drive is expected to be a watershed moment for the labor movement in the United States and especially in the American South, a region that has historically been difficult for workers to organize. For more on this, I'm joined by Carrie Lee Merritt, a historian, writer, and author of Masterless Men, Poor Whites, and Slavery in the Antebellum South. Carrie Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're talking here about unionizing efforts in one Amazon facility in Bessemer, Alabama. Why has that gotten so much national attention?
Well, I think for multiple reasons, but number one, the South has always been the most anti-labor region in the whole entire U.S., and particularly the Deep South. And that has its roots, of course, in slavery and the failures of Reconstruction and any kind of reparations, particularly for the descendants of the enslaved. And this has created huge inequality, not just in wealth, but in labor practices and in political power. So the South is where the right to work states come from, which has now kind of taken over much of the rest of the country, much of the Midwest. All of these really bad anti-labor laws have originated in the South.
You mentioned right to work. I'd love to define that before we go on this. What is a right to work state?
So many different laws make up these kind of right to work states, but the main one is they essentially gut unions by saying that workers do not have to pay union dues. And of course, you know, unions rely on these dues to put up any kind of fight against management. So by telling workers they don't have to pay union dues, that essentially guts union power, any kind of labor power in the South. And so you essentially have a Deep South that, with the exception of very few industries, is almost without unions altogether.
How does the Amazon union drive in Bessemer, Alabama, fit into the history of organized labor in the U.S.? Because we have seen renewed interest in unions. You know, then at the same time, as you mentioned, there's been a dwindling power of unions themselves. So where does this fit into that broader conversation? What's happening in Bessemer right now?
Well, I think, you know, this Amazon warehouse in particular is one of the biggest that Amazon has. I think it's over 6,000 employees. You also have a big, you know, racial disparity here as opposed to most other places. This particular plant is over 85% Black. And so it is amazing to see that, you know, I always say in the South, it's one of the most progressive places in the Deep South, particularly with Black workers and even with poor white workers. There are many instances of multiracial organizing and, you know, working for the same economic and labor issues. But because the elite white Southerners, basically the heirs of slaveholders, were never really overthrown, you know, you've got this incredibly monopolistic, monopsonistic South. And the disparity, not only in wealth, but in political power, is so great that elite whites have always been able to kind of crush out any labor solidarity or any major labor movement. And there have been so many throughout history in the South, not only just right after Reconstruction, but also in the populist movement in the 1890s and during the 1930s and 40s, where you literally have communists and socialists there organizing. There is this long movement of interracial cooperation and, you know, fighting for the rights of laborers and workers. But unfortunately, the balance of power has historically been, you know, so unbalanced that these movements have always been pretty much stamped out.
If efforts at this warehouse in Bessemer are successful and these workers are able to form a union, what does that mean exactly? I mean, they will be part of a larger union, won't they?
Yes. And basically, it means that they then have the power to work with management to come to some sort of understanding. This doesn't mean that they immediately have some sort of union contract. It just gives them the opportunity to work out a contract with management. So it's essentially just giving them the power to start this process. But I think on a national level, this has become so symbolic. And even on an international level, you know, international press is covering this like crazy. I think it's really going, if they win, it shows such hope in this country for the labor movement, larger labor movement. And I think it's so badly needed right now because we're still dealing with after effects, obviously, of the recession of 2008, but also, you know, what's coming, the backlash from the pandemic and all the jobs lost here is just going to make, you know, people at the lower end of the economic spectrum just desperate. And that's honestly what you need to have a strong labor movement, because people have to feel like they're almost at the point of having nothing to lose, that they've got to get out there and fight.
Would you suggest that workers here are at that point? Because particularly when it comes to Amazon, we've heard so many, even recently, so many stories about, you know, they're competing narratives, which is Amazon's marketing push and its commercials on television to show its workers, you know, are happy and satisfied with their jobs and have, you know, adequate personal protective equipment. And then there are the narratives that emerge through reporting and elsewhere that say Amazon workers have to, you know, urinate in plastic bottles and aren't allowed to take bathroom breaks and are being surveilled at every turn. So what would this actually do for Amazon workers, and would it affect Amazon workers nationally?
So it would give them so many more opportunities to claim rights for themselves. And I know there's been much made about, you know, Alabama in the South is a low wage region and they're paying $15 an hour, which is a, you know, a pretty good payment. But that's not exactly what this is about, right? This is about workers' rights and workers' protection, and even the protection of you know, immigrant workers. And so this is so much more than that. And I think we also have to think about it in terms of, you know, we don't have the rights in this country that every other country has in terms of social safety nets, in terms of, you know, universal health care. And so all of those things are dependent on jobs in this country, unfortunately. And so we have to have that tied into some sort of labor package for jobs to be, you know, anywhere close to humane for people in this society. And all of these aspects, unless the federal government changes, you know, the entire way this country runs, they're going to have to be fought for at the labor level.
What are some of the barriers to organizing that have been put forth, whether with Amazon directly or other companies where we see people trying to unionize, in some cases successfully, in other cases not?
Well, so historically, the police have been used, and we've seen that again in Bessemer. And reports are coming out that officers there are being paid by the company in their off time to come and police, you know, the grounds and police all around, you know, where these workers live. And it's really a tactic of intimidation, and it's been a long-standing tactic in the South. I mean, you go back to even the Klan and all of these white supremacist organizations, and at the heart of a lot of these was keeping laborers and keeping workers down in their place.
That's police intimidation. That can't be legal.
It's not. But again, like I said, particularly in the South and particularly in rural areas in the South, you know, power never really changes hands. And you've still got this small cadre of elite white people who control everything from politics to economics to the carceral state. And it's, you know, it's something that I think that's why we're couching this labor movement in terms of civil rights, because it really is civil rights.
We talked about what would happen if this is a successful vote, which we won't know for a while. It could be days, it could be weeks before we know the final result of the vote here. But what if it's not successful?
I think if it's not successful, you know, there will be a lot of sadness and a lot of people really disheartened. But we've just got to take a few days, you know, feel our feelings and get over it and realize that this is a movement. You know, it's a larger movement. And, you know, go on to the next project. They will have another year where they can vote again. So really try to, you know, get organizers in there, get at the grassroots level and reorganize. But you know, focus on the rest of the nation as well and really, really try to tie this into civil rights and make this a movement. Because as a historian, I really believe I'm seeing the beginnings of another civil rights movement. So hopefully, you know, this is a historic time. This is one of the few times in people's lifetimes where there is a chance to really make a change. And I think we're seeing it.
There is a little bit of support that we understand coming even from the from Washington. President Biden and the Democrats are pushing for something called the PRO Act, which would make labor organizing easier. Carrie Lee, what are your thoughts on the PRO Act? It's not directly related to Alabama and Bessemer and Amazon, but it could have further implications.
Oh, it is an amazing act. It would gut the right to work laws, essentially, which is incredibly important. And so, of course, that would change much of what's going on in the South and the Midwest. But it would also make it easier to form a union in all of these places. And the probably one of the most important aspects of it is it changes things in favor of striking workers, so that if somebody's on strike, they cannot be fired while they're on strike. And so that would change the labor game completely, you know, for people not have to be worried that they're fired if they go on strike.
Carrie Lee Merritt is a historian, a writer, and the author of Masterless Men, Poor Whites, and Slavery in the Antebellum South. Carrie Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to end today's show with something that should sound familiar to most of your ears. Nope, that's not a household generator or a low-flying airplane. Instead, it's the rhythmic thrum of cicadas, a staple of our summer soundscapes here in the United States. And this year, things might be a bit louder as billions of cicadas emerge from the earth after living underground for the past 17 years as part of the so-called Great Eastern Brood, or Brood 10. To put that in perspective, the last time we heard or saw Brood 10 was the same year that Facebook was launching as a social network, and the first legal same-sex marriage was taking place in Massachusetts. And it was also a time when Donald Trump was known as the host of The Apprentice rather than our former president. For more on the upcoming Once in 17-Year Cicada Spectacle, we're joined now by Dr. Matt Kasson, an associate professor of forest pathology and mycology at West Virginia University. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tanzina. Happy to be here.
There are thousands of cicada species worldwide. Why are we making such a big deal about the Brood 10?
Well, there are cicadas worldwide, about 3,000 species. But in North America, we have a very unique phenomenon, and that is the 13 and 17-year periodical cicadas. Nowhere else on Earth do we see such long-lived cicadas that spend most of their life underground to emerge in this truly spectacular spectacle. And their numbers are far surpass anything we've ever seen.
Now, just to be clear, these are harmless, right?
That's right. Oftentimes, people are afraid when they see large insects in large abundance, but they pose no threats to us as humans. They have kind of sucky mouth parts for feeding on the sap of trees. So even if they land on us, they can't hurt us. And they do have kind of sword-like structures on the back of females, and those are for laying eggs in woody tissue. So they can't sting us. They can't bite us.
So the cicadas of the Brood 10, which are periodical cicadas, how do they compare to the cicadas we see and hear annually?
Well, for one, they have a much longer life cycle. I mean, they're called 17-year cicadas because they spend so much time underground developing. Most of their life is spent in a juvenile stage, we call a nymph, feeding on the roots of plants underneath our feet. So they're there all along. We just don't notice them. But when they come up in kind of a synchronized fashion. So within a 2-week period, we'll see billions of cicadas emerge in the areas where they're known to occur. So this Brood 10 covers about 15 states. And we'll see a major epicenter in and around the greater DC area. This compares to annual cicadas that come out every year, but really don't have the numbers. You hear them, but you don't really see them. So the periodical cicadas, you can't miss seeing them just because they'll be up along with their billion other friends.
I'm going to pose an existential question here, Matt. Do these periodical cicadas, our brood tens, who have been developing underground for 17 years, do they have a purpose? And I guess that is existential in a lot of ways, but why? I mean, what is the point of them emerging right now? Or is it just strictly because of their cyclical development cycle?
Right. There's a lot of people that actually study the math behind cicada emergence. And obviously, there's a lot of theory that goes into it. But really, it's about predator evasion. If they wait long enough, then the collective memory of the predators that feed on them can't predict when they're going to come up. But when they do come up, they do provide a huge resource for every snake, bird, and fish in the area. They just basically fill all of them. So you see a real boom in those populations in years that cicadas emerge. The other benefit is of course the fertilizer that they add to the soil as they die and integrate back into the soil.
We played some sound at the very top of the segment here because that's a sound that a lot of people recognize. How do cicadas make their loud sounds, and how loud can they actually get? I mean, are we thinking, you know, we're going to be trying to do the show and all windows have to be closed so we can avoid cicada background noise here?
Yeah, great question. Well, when you're hearing cicadas, you're really only hearing the males. The males are the ones that that have a call, and that call is meant to impress a female into being receptive to mating. So the periodical cicadas are actually three distinct species. So you have three separate calls by males to impress their respective females. So you're hearing kind of the overlap of three different cicada species in time and space. And to answer your other question, how loud is it? You know, if you've ever sat next to, you know, high tension power lines or a generator going nonstop, it can be deafening outside, especially in kind of more heavily wooded areas, wooded suburban environments or wooded parks around urban environments, definitely.
So it's also it's a mating call, essentially. And if all of these male cicadas are out here making all this noise, do they drown each other out?
Absolutely. In fact, they have to get close enough to the female to have her hear their call. But they're also waiting for a female to flick her wings to indicate that she's receptive to mating. So they get as close as they can, they scream as loud as they can, and they wait for her to flick her wings and say, okay, I'm open to the idea of mating.
Matt, I had to laugh because it sounds like the lady cicadas are in charge here.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
You have to be excited about the fact that the brood 10 are emerging, right? For scientists, for folks in your community, you're a forest pathology and mycology professor here. What does this mean for you? I mean, this has got to be a pretty big deal, waiting 17 years for this emergence.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And this is the biggest. So there's a lot of excitement around that. There are other broods that emerge in other years. And we, as people that study cicadas, and we study fungi that infect cicadas, we're always traveling around to find these broods in various locations. But with brood 10, you don't have to travel too far because it's emerging in 15 states, whereas other broods might be restricted to just a few counties in one state. So it's a real great opportunity to look at, you know, different aspects of the cicada life cycle and understand more about its genetics and its the contemporary pressures and things like that.
Less than a minute to go. Any apps for the cicada curious, people who want to follow where these cicadas are going?
Yeah, I would definitely encourage people to check out iNaturalist and Safari Cicada, which are two great apps for tracking cicadas. But, you know, just encourage you to get out there and see them because it really is a true spectacle.
Sounds like an amazing thing. Matt Kasson is an associate professor of forest pathology and mycology at West Virginia University. Matt, thanks so much for sharing all wisdom cicada related with us. We really appreciate that.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Thank you so much for making us a part of your Wednesday. And we love hearing your thoughts, and it's super easy. Just record a voice memo and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And don't forget, you can always leave a message at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or, of course, you can tweet us. We're at The Takeaway. We'll have more for you tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.